Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and I'm so pleased to be talking to my friend of like 25 years, Douglas Preston, about his new AXL Pendergast thriller called Crooked River. Doug.
Well, Barbara, it's great to be here. I'm looking forward to talking to you about the book.
And Lincoln as well, because we have to do it by Skype. But I thought this book did some really interesting things. You always put them in unusual places, but I thought that your writing about Florida was particularly lyrical. I mean, you have some great descriptive scenes about Sanibel and Captiva.
Well, one of the nice things is that both Lincoln and I have been there. Sometimes when we write a book, I've been there and he hasn't, or vice versa. But in this case, we both had been there. And I went to Sanibel and Captiva when I was a kid with my parents, and then later they had a wedding anniversary, and we all went to Captiva as a family and rented a place. And I love that island. It's so beautiful. It's so perfect. It's not developed like the rest of Florida, and of course that made a wonderful contrast with the horror of what we imagined that happens there.
Yes, this is actually one of your more brutal novels in terms of the crimes that are committed, because what we find is shoes washing up on the beach with actual human feet inside.
Well, you know, it's funny. My wife, Christine, is a reader, and she read this book, and when she read it in one day, she was absolutely couldn't stop reading it. But when she was done, she said, "Doug, you and Lincoln went too far. This book goes too far. It's horrible. Don't write another book like this. It's too much." So I don't know if I should take that as a compliment or what.
Well, you know, thrillers are not for the lily-livered readers. Let's face it. I mean, you know, there are a lot of thrillers that have some very dark components. I thought your wonderful first book for Nora Kelly, Old Bones, that we did another one of these events, and possibly, I can't remember, a podcast for last August. I mean, that wasn't for chickens either. There was some bad stuff that went on with the Donner Party and cannibalism and people freezing to death in the mountains.
Well, that's right. I mean, I guess you might say that we're attracted to dark stories. And the Donner story, the cannibalism story, is really one of the darkest stories in American history. And it's always fascinated me. For decades, I've thought about that story, and all of a sudden, you know, I was talking to Lincoln about it, and we had this idea, because I've been reading about there have been two archaeological excavations of Donner sites, and they've been very interesting. I've been following that and so forth, and Lincoln and I thought, what if there was a third camp, and there's an archaeological excavation of this third camp, and they discover something even more horrible than cannibalism.
Ooh, what a killer premise. I love that. But in point of fact, though, I thought that you put it into a context that made a lot more sense than it was just, I mean, these were people in extremis. You know, they were frozen in, they didn't see any really good escape. It was the struggle for survival. It reminded me a lot of, and I'm trying to remember the name of, I'm having one of those blanks, but you know the book that was a bestseller about the tiger and they made a movie out of it?
Oh, The Life of Pi.
Thank you, The Life of Pi. And at the end, you realize, having tracked the movie with the tiger in the boat and the whole bit, that it was essentially this guy eating the other people in the boat in order to survive. So it too was a novel about cannibalism.
Yeah. Well, in Old Bones, we were very careful to not sensationalize or make these people turn into brutes or anything like that. I mean, as you say, they were in extremis, and they did what they had to do to survive, and you can't fault people for that. So, starvation cannibalism is something where you're in a very strange kind of moral world. And we wanted to retain that. We didn't want to turn it into some horrible, sensationalistic thing. But we came up with another idea, which is completely separate from the cannibalism, that was even worse. And that was no fault of anybody on the Donner Party. That was just a circumstance that was beyond anyone's control.
Well, I mean, part of the tragedy of the Donner Party is that it didn't need to happen. They made a poor choice, and then they were actually very close to pushing through.
That's right. They were 3 months. The party was strung out in the mountains, but the people in the front were only 3 miles from the pass.
Right.
If they had gotten over that pass before the snow fell, they might have been able to get down the other side. But the snow started to fall. They said, "Oh, let's not go over the pass. Let's camp." And then in the morning, we'll get 3-4 inches of snow. Well, the snow kept falling and falling and falling. I mean, there were 3 feet of snow, and they were absolutely frozen in place. And the party was strung out, so that's why there were more than one camp.
Right. Actually, you know, some of the deaths on Mount Everest are due to similar bad choices and bad execution and people who didn't need to die. But modern technology is so different. I've never forgotten, I think the guy was from New Zealand, but maybe Australia, but one of the guys that had taken people up there, and now they're snowed in and they're in their tent and they're clearly going to die because they're not. And the last thing he did was pull out his satellite phone and call home. You know, I've always thought that was the creepiest thing, you know. I mean, it's so horrible that here he is. You know, he's able to talk to his family on his phone, but he can't get down from the mountain and he's about to freeze to death. And I've always thought that was the grimmest kind of a story.
I know, that in a way that's far grimmer than what happened to the Donner Party. I mean, the Donner Party were completely cut off for months from the outside world, and they were... The courage and the pioneer spirit of those people was something that we admire.
Right.
Whereas people who climb Mount Everest with the latest equipment, the cell phones, the guides who are hauling them up the mountain, sometimes have to wait in line to get to the summit. To me, that does not reflect an adventuring, pioneering human spirit. I won't say any more about that. I just disapprove of it.
Well, you've climbed a lot of mountains in a lot of places, so...
Oh, I've climbed some big mountains, and I climbed the highest mountain in Colorado in the dead of winter, which was a very difficult climb. I've done ice climbing, climbing up frozen waterfalls, but I've never had to wait in line to get anywhere. I mean, the whole point of getting into the wilderness is to be alone, to appreciate the beauty of the wilderness and of being alone. That's the whole point of it. And I've never had to step over dead or dying people in order to get to my goal, which I think is morally reprehensible.
It's a bucket list kind of a thing. And I like the Nora Kelly. I like her as a character, and I'm hoping, and I think you're planning, to continue that series.
Oh, we've got a new novel that we're working on. We're right in the middle of it, and I'm so excited by this book. It's called Scorpion's Tale, and it takes place... in New Mexico near the White Sands Missile Range, and Corey Swanson is now a young FBI agent working out of the Albuquerque office, and Nora Kelly is an archaeologist in New Mexico, and once again they have to team up on what looks like they find a body, they don't know how he died, it looks like somebody who might have died maybe 75 years ago, but the FBI has to investigate because it might be a homicide, and it's on federal land. And so Nora Kelly is called in to excavate, and boy, what they discover is something absolutely mind-blowing. I wish I could tell you, but those are
spoilers. No, don't. I want to be excited about when I read it. Do you think that it's necessary to have a body to have a murder and a thriller?
Well, you know, I've often thought it'd be great to, instead of a body and all you have is 6 quarts of blood, because that's how much blood is in a human body. So you know it's a murder, but you don't have the body.
You know, I used to love books like King Solomon's Mines and Scaramouche, and you know, there were a lot of thrillers that were written where it was an adventure or treasure or shipwreck, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, murders that powered it. So in a way,
true.
You know, it's kind of a hybrid to have a murder investigation and a thriller all in the same book. But you and Lincoln do that very well.
Well, thank you. It actually, that what you say is interesting. It'd be fun to write a book like our book, The Pharaoh Key, which is a novel which involves our character Gideon Crewe. was sort of an adventure story like King Solomon's Mines or She, you know, that H. Rider Haggard books. People do die, but it's much, the adventure is much more important than the murders, and there really aren't murders, it's just deaths.
Right, and that's a very good distinction. Lincoln actually wrote a really terrific book set in Egypt in a swamp where you never think of Egypt as, or, you know, the Nile River as having a swamp. But it, too, was a book that was really more about deaths than it was about murders.
It was, yeah. That, what was that, that?
I can't remember. I've had a glass of wine with you, plus it's a senior moment, so I'm not going to be good on titles. But
anyway, well, that was a great book. Yeah, that,
it
that
was a wonderful book. I really enjoyed it.
The Third Gate.
Thank you. Yeah. I like your standalones. I think Lincoln's written some very good ones, and you certainly have written some. I mean, one of our all-time best-selling books at the Poison Pen is The Lost City of the Monkey God, which, in fact, is not only a standalone by you, but nonfiction.
Well, I was really surprised. That book was on the bestseller list forever, and it's still selling incredibly well. It just doesn't stop selling. And I think what's going on there is word of mouth. People are, you know, telling their friends to buy the book because there's no advertising out there. It's just people talking to their friends.
I know, as I mentioned to you last night, the second season of Jack Ryan, produced, I love this, executive producer Tom Clancy, so I'm not sure what that's all about, but it probably is a nod to the Clancy estate. But anyway, they're using the LIDAR that, you know, you used, or your expedition to the Lost City was prompted by the use of LIDAR to discover it in the jungle. And this is something new called flash LIDAR, where they're looking for mineral deposits under the ground in Venezuela.
Well, it's not exactly scientific, but I did notice after The Monkey God was published that a lot of books, a lot of thrillers took the LIDAR idea and started using it for thrillers. But, you know, LIDAR is very real technology. It's incredible what they're discovering with
it. Well, I think it's a real technology, and if it's used, if it's appropriated for some more exotic use, so what?
Well, I'll say the most exotic use right now, it turns out that LIDAR and not radar is what is being used for self-driving cars.
Is it really?
It's better than radar. It's more accurate. It's more, has higher resolution. And that is where now, right now, not in the future, but right now the self-driving cars are going to LIDAR.
That's fascinating. Wow. Well, you've always been interested in science, which is one of the things I think makes you such an interesting writer. But let's go back to Crooked River. Part of the reason that I'm so entranced with your descriptions of Sanibel and Captiva is that I am a lifelong reader of Randy Wayne White, who not only lives on Sanibel Island, writes about Sanibel Island, and his books are mostly set right there with Doc Ford, his guy. But he also has a chain of restaurants on Sanibel and Captiva and adjacent islands. So I already knew about that before I read your book. And I know I found it fun to compare, because I mean, he's done some interesting archaeological things. For example, the shell mounds that, you know, the Native Americans in Florida before the Spanish arrived and so forth had created, you know, these kind of islands made just basically out of cast off shells, presumably from shellfish that people ate.
That's right. Yeah, well, that kind of Captiva and Sanibel make for a wonderful setting, because it's such a off the beaten path in Florida, and yet there's so much color and history there, and, you know, the Native Americans and everything else. It's really an interesting.
But aren't they barely connected to Florida by a causeway?
Yeah, there's a causeway going out to Sanibel, and then there's another causeway that goes to Captiva.
Right.
So those are, you know, it's sort of like the Florida Keys, except the causeways are much shorter.
So you can do an almost kind of Treasure Island kind of story, because, you know, you're not somewhere on, you know, interstate, whatever it is in Florida. You are in a place that's harder to access.
Yeah, and then people are trapped. And that's what part of what makes our novel interesting is that, you know, this is, you know, you can't get off Captiva Island except over the Blind Pass Bridge, or unless you have a boat. So you're really trapped there. If something bad happens, it's going to be kind of difficult to get off that island.
And Agent Pendergast is still there after the events in Verses for the Dead. He's still in Florida.
That's right. He's staying in that Victorian house.
Right. But Constance is a big presence in this book. Constance has quite a role.
Well, she does. You know, she's with Pendergast in Florida, but she has a problem with salt water in the ocean. She's afraid of water. She's afraid of the ocean. She's not a beach person. So she... when these feet come washing in on the tide, she is so horrified by that. She wants nothing to do with the investigation, but she finds that the Victorian house that they're renting has this mystery, this of a ghost story associated with it. And so she decides, well, I don't like the beach. I don't want to have anything to do with this investigation. So instead, I'm going to investigate the ghost story. And that's what she does, with a very interesting result.
It is interesting. In the meantime, you have Roger Smithbank, who's trying to, you know, really make his bones at the Miami Herald, and he's running around trying to write a story about the whole thing.
Yeah, so, Roger Smithbank, he makes a big mistake as a reporter. Can't go into any detail there, but he gets on the wrong track and pisses off the wrong people.
Do you have a grudge against Smithbanks? I mean, you've killed one, and now you're giving the other one a hard time.
We are very fond of Roger Smithbank. I don't think he's in any danger of dying. I feel terrible about what happened to his brother, Bill.
Yes, it's really hard to kill a member of an ensemble cast without reverberation, right?
I know. People have really been upset at us for that.
Plus, you do a really daring thing with the police chief in this book, which I will not mention, which I think you're going to get some flack over personally. But
oh, you think so?
Oh, I absolutely do. Right. But we'll see what happens. There is a hint, people, when you read the book. But anyway, one of the other things I particularly liked was that part of the problem is that these shoes with feet are drifting in on the tide. And the question is, where are they coming from? So you do spend a lot of time with, working out, mapping. I won't go into the whole thing, but I thought it was a fascinating exercise, you know, about how they used technology to try to figure out where the shoes had been put into the water and why.
Well, we studied very, very carefully the Malaysian Airlines, you know, Flight 370.
Right.
Where they found pieces of that plane that washed up in Reunion Island and other parts of the Indian Ocean. And these tremendous, you know, computer programs were trying to trace back, do a drift analysis back in time to figure out where those pieces might have come from so they could locate where the plane went down. And so the most sophisticated computer programs were developed. And so we researched that, and then we put all that wonderful technological information into this novel because they're trying to figure out where these severed feet came from. You know, did they come from Cuba? Were they dumped from a boat? How did they get, where did they come into the water? Where could they have come from? And they know that they were dumped in the water, you know, a certain number of weeks before by studying the rate of decomposition. So they're trying to do this reverse drift analysis, and of course, well, I don't want to go into too much detail.
No spoilers, but I thought it was a great use of technology. My final comment before we run out of time is I particularly liked the Coast Guard, and I thought the most humorous part of the book was the exercise the Coast Guard ran off the coast of Cuba. I don't want to give anything away, but I have to tell you, you kind of led us down the garden path with that one. The resolution of it is hilarious.
We had a lot of fun with that. I actually know a lot about the Coast Guard and boats. I actually have a Coast Guard credential. I'm a licensed sea captain. And so I know how the Coast Guard operates, and so I had a lot of fun with that. Although I'm sure the Coast Guard is going to be not happy with what I did with that information.
Probably not. But, you know, one of the things that makes your book so interesting is you bring so many, you and Lincoln between you, bring so many things to the writing that, you know, lots of writers don't have any command over. I mean, you know science, you know archaeology, you know, well, the Coast Guard, as you just pointed out. Have either one of you ever spent any time with the FBI?
We have. We've gone on what they call ride-alongs, you know, and Link has has a very close friend who's in ATF, and I have a couple of friends who are in the FBI. And it's funny, because my friends in the FBI say to me, you know, Doug, the one thing you never show in your novels, you never show them doing the paperwork. You wouldn't believe how much paperwork we have to do. And I say, you know what? That all takes place off screen. We're not going to see them doing the paperwork. Sorry.
Yes, it would certainly slow down the pace of the thriller. But, you know, I mean, Pendergast is an FBI agent. And so, you know, he has to have some sort of nodding acquaintance. And now you've got Nora and Corey, you know, involved in it, too. And so Lincoln, I think, is working on another standalone. And you have maybe a nonfiction project or two going. So it seems like there's just no end of books coming from the two of you.
Well, we never run out of ideas. People say, are you ever afraid you're going to run out of ideas? And the answer is, we have too many ideas. We've got to live a few more lifetimes.
You know, that's really true. I'm worried that you won't get to write all the books you want to write.
Oh, we won't. We're definitely going to die before we write all the books we want to write. But that's how it is.
You bet. It's a very happy situation. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Barbara.